Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There absolutely needs to be a winter plan now. Last month would have been nicer.
As homeless campers in Anchorage try to stay out of the rain, advocates say the city needs to plan for winter. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, scientists say tundra fires in Alaska could become more frequent.
After decades of warmer springs and summers, there's just more to burn.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Anchorage has been inundated with rain for the last few weeks. At the Centennial Campground in East Anchorage, it's made for wet and muddy conditions for the dozens of homeless people staying there in tents. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on how campers are working to stay dry.
It's raining at Centennial Campground as camper Esteban Diaz spends his morning tying a large tarp above his tent and a picnic table at his camp space.
See, I have two tarps on top of my tent that keeps provided for keeping wet. And also I have another one on top to keep, you know, I got two tarps because even if you have just have the rain fly, you still get wet.
Diaz is wearing a rain jacket and has a campfire going. He's one of more than 180 people staying at the campground, which turned into a makeshift homeless camp in late June after Mayor Dave Bronson started waiving camping fees at the site and closed the city's biggest shelter. Meanwhile, Anchorage summer has turned from hot and dry to what feels like constant rain, with more rainy conditions in the forecast. Diaz says the Salvation Army, which took over client coordination at the camp last month, is trying to help. It has provided the tents and tarps as well as firewood. Diaz says there's just a few more things he could use.
Besides that, just good rain gear, you know, good rain gear, a heater to keep everything dry, good heater, because I got electricity, I got power. We got power, but no heater.
Nearby is Luis Garcia, who just moved into the campground after camping around town for the last 2 months. He says people with camping experience like himself and Diaz are faring well despite the rain, but other people are struggling.
Especially like old ladies and old folks right there, they don't know how to set up the tent, they got soaking wet.
One of the campers having a rougher experience is Kenneth Walker Jr. He described the last few weeks as a, quote, never-ending battle with the weather.
A lot of my stuff was still wet from when I ended up leaving, and somehow, like, wind blew the tarp. Rain got in the tent, and just a struggle to keep up with the laundry and trying to keep those clean.
Walker says he recently learned that the Salvation Army is working to help swap out campers' wet clothes and blankets with clean, dry ones. Denise Delgado is Anchorage Social Services Director for the Salvation Army. She says she's been working with city officials to better set up campsites for the rain.
Especially for the individuals that aren't on actual rock bed that where it can drain. So they are bringing in pallets that we can now lift people up off the ground. And so we're going to be lifting it up with pallet, tarp, and then the tent on top.
Walker says it's not just the rain he's worried about, but also planning ahead for the winter. He says he needs to start stocking up on extra blankets and propane.
Maybe get some more stuff to insulate the tent too. That's what I was thinking about this morning, just because how quick the heat was leaving the tent.
Roger Branson is concerned about the approaching winter, too. He's on the city's Homeless Prevention and Response System Advisory Council and is often at Centennial helping connect campers to supplies and resources. He says having a winter plan is a critical and immediate need.
There absolutely needs to be a winter plan now. Last month would have been nicer, you know. A year ago, we did have a plan going in, and it was wholly rejected and has not been replaced. And it's been a very frustrating year.
The city says it plans to build a new shelter, but it won't be ready until at least November. Assembly members have criticized the Bronson administration for not having a winter sheltering plan yet. The assembly recently approved creating a task force to come up with a winter plan. Branson says the plan needs input from people who are houseless and have been camping outside.
These people in the camps know where their help comes from. They know who they can trust, and we need to listen to them. We need to let them make their own choices.
Back at Diaz's tent, he says he thinks he'll be prepared to continue camping after the first snowfall.
I'll stick around here. Ain't nothing for me. Winter, I live in 70 below zero, 50 below zero Fairbanks. So this for me outside, it doesn't do nothing. I mean, I got snow gear. I got a parka there. You know, I got Arctic gear. Once you're outside for 2 weeks, you acclimatize.
As for Garcia, he's hoping he'll only have to hold out at Centennial for a couple months more.
I'm studying to get my commercial driver's license, and I'm going to get a job as a truck driver and live in a truck. Probably, trying to finance one truck myself.
He says he's hoping he'll be able to pay for the license and any fees when his PFD drops into his account next month. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
This winter's Alaska Marine Highway schedule has ferries running for more weeks than last year, but still leaves some communities with large service gaps. The State Department of Transportation released a draft schedule for October through April this week. The Southwest region will see more sailings than last year, but no service in January and February. Prince William Sound will be without service in October and November, but will see calls from the Aurora between December and April. Small communities in the northern panhandle may also spend most of January and February without ferry service. And two of the state's largest ferries will be out of service most of the winter for overhauls. The Matanuska, serving the mainline route through southeast, won't run at all, but the Columbia will be back online in November. Ferry system spokesman Sam Dapsovich says that means there won't be a gap in mainline service for the first time since 2019.
The Columbia is going to be ready to go in November, and it will run the entire winter schedule all the way through April 30th.
The Kennecott is slated to fill in for the Matanuska in October, running from the lower 48 to Prince Rupert through southeast. Then it'll go in for service for nearly 6 months.
It goes into overhaul November 1st, and it doesn't come back out until April 20th. So that's longer than usual for not having cross-Gulf service.
The state is accepting written comments on its ferry plan until August 26th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new app helps people in Sitka track landslide warnings.
I've been here 35 years and just never thought about landslides until then as a big worry. Mostly we worried about tsunamis.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
School is back in session across the state, and it was the first day of school yesterday for Alaska's largest school district in Anchorage. And this year, Anchorage has a new superintendent. Dr. Jarrett Bryant begins his tenure with a shortage of bus drivers causing reduced bus service, a crisis, as Bryant calls it, as well as other staffing issues and concerns about safety felt nationwide following one of the deadliest ever school shootings in U.S. history near the end of last school year in Uvalde, Texas. As school is getting started in Anchorage, Bryant says there are both short and long-term plans to address those problems.
There is definitely light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to bus driver staffing. We have about 55 people who are in the queue to start driving ASD buses by the end of September, and we're hoping that number continues to go up. Recently, we have about 70 vacancies, so gradually we'll be able to start having conversations around what does restoring full bus service look like in the coming months.
Yeah, speaking of, I guess, ASD is dealing with a teacher shortage as well, like a lot of places. In your previous role in Texas, you had worked on teacher recruitment and retention, right? So are there tactics from that past job that you think will work here in Anchorage?
There are. So in my previous role, I led talent. So my job focused on the evaluation, the recruitment, the retention, the compensation of 26,000 employees in my previous gig. Here, there are many of the same challenges, and there are a lot of things that we haven't tried here in ASD that I think that we can. For example, I noticed this summer that we had vacancies in special education. So we were able to provide additional compensation to that specific subgroup of special education teachers. And that's new. Giving additional compensation in Alaska to a very particular part of a bargaining unit is not very common. And I think it's a step in the right direction. On my end, though, something I'm excited would be around the retention to being an ASD employee. I really want people to come to ASD and have long, fulfilling careers here. So I think about teachers and their unfortunate realities around policy in Alaska that keep some of our teachers here from getting defined benefits, a path to having a retirement, a long-term retirement plan, which is not common in a lot of states. So unless we take action on the district level and the policy level, we're on track to be a revolving door of educators. And that's not what I want for our current teachers, thinking about where do they get energy? If you want to be the best teacher in the city, in the Pacific Northwest, what can I do to get you training? Maybe get you national board certified, maybe give you opportunities to coach your peers or to be a department chair to lead your teams. Those are the types of things that I'm really proud of that we did in Houston that gave people a sense that ASD is looking out for me. ASD wants me to be here for my career, and they're looking out for me not just for my needs of today, but for the needs that maybe I don't even know that I have that come 4 or 5 years from now. So I'm really hoping to create a stronger talent life cycle when it comes to our employees. In fact, attracting and retaining talent is one of my three priorities as superintendent.
A talent life cycle. I have never heard that phrase.
That's right. That's my HR jargon for you.
Some of that, to me, it sounds more like policy and maybe higher level stuff. But when you're interfacing directly with teachers, what are the kind of things that you're talking about to try to, you know, build support or build trust with them?
I want to understand what a day is like in their shoes. What are the things that they're thinking about? What does support look like? So, for example, I got to welcome hundreds of new teachers to ASD for the first time a couple weeks ago. They're so excited. Their optimism and enthusiasm is sky high. And we designed a couple of days for them to really talk about the stuff that new teachers are going through or somebody new to ASD is going through. And we got to target that. And I think there are things that we can do for our experienced teachers to really target their needs. That's the direction I want to go with all of our groups in some way, shape, or form, including our principals. So we need to make sure that their professional development is ongoing and relevant to what they're thinking. And that's not going to happen unless I get out there and I ask them, like, hey, like, what are you thinking about? What do you need support with? How do you want to become better? Do you feel that you have all the tools in your toolbox to be successful? What's keeping you up at night? And that way, as a leadership team, we can take action that helps address this at the system level.
You mentioned talking to teachers about and principals about the things that keep them up at night. And you know, I know some teachers and I know some parents, and that one of the things that keeps them up at night is worrying about violence in schools or like a school shooting situation. And I hate to bring that up, but I just wonder, what do you think about that? What is ASD doing to prevent a situation like that?
Safety is at the forefront of my mind. I'm from Texas. I've been to Uvalde, Texas, and I know it's very scary to be in an event in which the safety of our staff and students is put in jeopardy. There are a lot of things that the school district can do to help augment that. I am noticing a lot of gaps in our infrastructure. I was at Denali Montessori today, which actually is a model for what I want for all of our schools. We had an event at Denali Montessori not too long ago where it could have, a terrible situation could have escalated and gotten into our schools, and a safety vestibule kept someone involved in an altercation from entering that school. An emergency button was pressed that allowed police to be deployed to the school within 2 minutes. That's something that I want for every school, and we need to compel the community to stand behind us to make those investments in infrastructure. That could look like a bond. That could look like advocacy at the state level, but we need to do whatever we can do to get this infrastructure right as quickly as we can. I am alarmed about it.
That was Anchorage School District Superintendent Dr. Jarrett Bryant. You can find an extended version of our interview at alaskapublic.org. In June, the largest tundra fire the region has ever seen ripped through the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Life is now going back to normal for residents, but as KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports, people should expect more frequent tundra fires in coming years.
See, right close our camp, and it burned.
I'm in St. Mary's, in the home of Elders Sophie and Patrick Beans. Sophie is showing me a vintage photo of their cabin, nestled into a spruce grove on the Andrefsky River. Now, all those spruce trees have burned down. The surrounding tundra is black. That's because a massive fire ripped through the tundra just outside of St. Mary's about 2 months ago. It was the largest tundra fire the region has ever seen. It has left a few obvious signs of its presence in its wake. The Beans camp was one of them. They were recently there to survey the damage.
Does it look a little sad?
Really, I took picture of that one place where we usually get the blackberries.
Besides burned berry patches, there are a few other signs of fire in St. Mary's still, like torn-up tundra trenches encircling the city, scorched earth, and leftover red fire retardant. Besides that, life has largely gone back to normal in St. Mary's. The vulnerable residents who evacuated to Bethel or Anchorage have all returned. The nearly 200 firefighters have long gone home. The commemorative hashtag East Fork Fire t-shirt sales have ended. But that doesn't mean residents should let their guard down.
The idea that there's going to be more fire on the tundra, I think, is a done deal. After decades of warmer springs and summers, there's just more to burn.
Climate scientist Rick Toman from the University of Alaska Fairbanks says climate change is contributing to more frequent wildfires in the YK Delta. The summer has seen the most acreage burned for what most consider to be the YK Delta region. And Toman says most of the large wildfires have occurred in the past 7 years. Toman says the cause of most of those fires has been lightning, and lightning has become much more common in the YK Delta over recent years. That's because more heat emanating from a warmer Bering Sea causes more moisture in the air. That moisture in turn causes more frequent thunderstorms. And when the lightning from those storms strikes the tundra, which is now usually drier from less snowmelt and more heat, fire can spread fast and far. Elders along the lower Yukon River also report thicker and denser vegetation over recent years, which can serve as fuel for fires. Toman says people should be on the lookout for more fires in the summer to come.
There's got to be more land burned. That's a sure thing.
In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
A landslide warning system developed in Sitka is now available to the public as an online app, and work is underway to export the project to other communities in Southeast Alaska. The app was unveiled at a meeting of the Sitka School Board Wednesday night. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Lisa Bush is the director of the Sitka Sound Science Center, which spearheaded the project. Bush is a 35-year resident of Sitka, and landslides were not on her radar until a very bad day 7 years ago.
So this project got started in 2015 when we had a deadly landslide that killed our friends and family. And I can say that I've been here 35 years and just never thought about landslides until then as a big worry. Mostly we worried about tsunamis. And all of a sudden, people had lots of concerns and lots of questions.
What emerged from that disaster on August 18th, 2015, was an interdisciplinary research program funded by a $2 million grant from the National Science Foundation. Partners ranged from the RAND Corporation, which did social science, to the U.S. Geological Survey and the National Weather Service, which collected hard data, to the Sitka Tribe of Alaska, which gathered oral histories. In all, there were 30 scientists and university researchers on the team. Bush said the final product had to serve a unique purpose, to give people enough information on if and when to act.
People said to us, and I think this is very Alaskan, they wanted to make their own decisions. They wanted a digital dashboard that where they could go and look at the risk and then make their own choices about if they should evacuate.
This is intentionally different from the tsunami warning system, which issues loud and insistent orders to evacuate and is more or less binary. A big earthquake occurs and a tsunami is either there or it's not. Landslides are the result of factors that are cumulative, in particular, how much rain has fallen or is expected to fall in a 3-hour period. And unlike tsunamis, the landslide risk is not shared equally across town.
We looked at where are the more landslide-prone areas and where part of Sitka is really most prone to landslides. And by the way, it's not the whole town. It's about 10% of our community. So when the landslides first happened, everybody said, well, we're all in a landslide zone. Well, that's not true. About 10% of homes are in landslide areas.
The Sitka Landslide Warning App is a web app which opens in a web browser. It shows low, medium, and high risk and generates a curve based on current conditions plus the forecast to anticipate risk up to 3 days into the future. It's got recommendations on how to evaluate the information based on where you live and what you should do if you decide to leave your home. The app is still being fine-tuned. Emergency planners hope to create messaging to help residents manage landslide risk moving forward.
What the emergency response people would like is for you to find a buddy system. So my house maybe is close to the water, and so I'm more prone to being hit by tsunamis. And my friend's house is someplace else where I can go when there's a tsunami warning. And then when there's a landslide warning, my friend can come down to my house and be in my safe house. And so we're saying, you know, uphill for tsunamis, downhill for a landslide.
Sitka is just the beginning for what Bush hopes becomes a regional landslide warning system. Work is already in progress to create similar warning systems in Hoonah, Skagway, Klukwan, Craig, Kasan, and Yakutat. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A family with deep roots in Soldotna has been named the 2022 Alaska Farm Family of the Year. The award comes nearly 75 years after the family first homesteaded on the Kenai Peninsula and set up a commercial farm there. KDLL's Sabine Pooks spoke with the current owners about that history and has the story.
Martha Mary's home on Pickle Hill is a bona fide farmhouse. The dozens of garlic plants drying on the floor of her living room during a rainy spell are a dead giveaway.
The instructions I read on curing garlic was withdraw water from it for a week or so before you pull it.
It's a little late in the season for garlic. Mary, stepping over a row of scapes, says she's not sure she's going to bring this garlic to the Lancashire farm stand at the market like she usually does.
So I'm just going to mince those and use them for the family.
Which we do love it when the garlic scapes come on.
Martha Mary and Amy Seitz run Lancashire Farms in Soldotna. And this year, they're the Alaska Farm Family of the Year, an accolade given by the state at the Alaska State Fair to honor a family that epitomizes a commitment to local agriculture. Lancashire Farms has been committed to that goal for longer than most. Larry and Rusty Lancashire arrived in Alaska in 1948 by way of Ohio. They were some of the first homesteaders in Soldotna and one of the few homesteading families that farmed commercially and stuck with it. Mary, not even 5 years old in 1948, says her dad's interest in farming was rooted in his time in World War II. While he was serving as a pilot, his plane was shot down, and he spent over a year in a prisoner of war camp.
While he was there, Red Cross would send some books. Some were about farming, and so he looked at some of those. And
after he got out, he tried careers in insurance sales and in crop dusting, but Mary says neither stuck.
So then when crop dusting didn't pan out and insurance didn't pan out, and he decided to come north. So it took him quite a while to drive a half-ton Jeep pulling 4 tons on a trailer up the Alcan.
When the Lancashires finally arrived in Alaska, they set up shop on the property the farm sits on today, on Pickle Hill.
I think Dad always had in mind having a commercial farm. So first he, you know, everybody needs to have eggs, so he raised chickens.
But the neighbors weren't so warm to the idea at first. Mary says the people in nearby Kenai were so used to eating dried eggs that they didn't take much to their fresh ones.
And so they had tried dairy cattle. After all, every family needs milk. But likewise, the people in Kenai were so used to canned milk that they didn't like fresh 33% Guernsey gold.
Finally, the family got into potatoes. They'd sell them on contract up at Anchorage. And eventually, Larry Lancashire got out of the farm business altogether. He bought Larry's club in Soldotna and became a commercial fisherman. But farming stayed in the family. His granddaughter, Amy Seitz, grew up spending summers on the farm and doing 4-H.
Which I've always been interested in the farm. You know, I always knew this is where I wanted to be.
Today, the farm does most of its sales directly from the property and at the Soldotna Saturday Farmers Market. They also sell eggs to Odie's, plus yarn spun from their sheep's wool at shops around the peninsula. And they're working on expanding how much they can produce, bringing in more sheep for the meat and fiber, and expanding production on plants, like the garlic.
We need more layers. We need to do more meat chickens. We need to sort out our sheep and have more production there.
And the historic farm has been adding new plants into its rotation too, like yadfa, a brassica from Asia, and celtis, a cultivar known for its thick leaves and stems. Seitz is also the head of the Alaska Farm Bureau, and she says there's a lot of enthusiasm today statewide about local food, driven in part by the recognition that Alaska's really cut off from the rest of the world. Mary also says people recognize that local produce just tastes better. It's a far cry from those early days in Kenai.
I think there's a lot of interest in homesteading and growing gardens and learning how, and I think that is really good. So I think it's important that we as farmers reach out and help individuals learn to garden on their own area.
Mary and Seitz are heading to the State Fair in Palmer this weekend. They'll be presented with the Farm Family of the Year Award on August 25th. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts, including on Spotify now. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Anchorage, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Sabine Pooks in Soldotna. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Eric Bork. Katie Anastas is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.